Well, thank you so much for coming. I am honored that so many people turned out to hear me talk a little bit about what we're going to call surgical safari. We're going to talk about the high complexity and the low resources and how that's a problem. So we have several goals today. I want to talk to you guys a little bit about the disparities in surgical care that's available in sub-Saharan Africa. We want to talk about some of the more innovative and unique models to try to increase that capacity, and talk some about some of the challenges of providing surgical care in a very resource-poor setting. So those are the, you know, program list goals of what we're going to talk about. But my fourth and hidden goal for you guys is that I want you guys to be inspired to be involved in medical, surgical, humanitarian work in some way. And I think the theme of this conference, talking about take the first step, really shows you that there's a role for everybody here. And we'll talk a little bit about how 2 years ago I was in your seat, literally sitting in here thinking, where is my next step? How can I, a busy surgeon with no time and no institutional support, get time to go and serve people in an under-resourced setting? And I'll tell you a little bit about how I did that as well. So we'll start with part of my story. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but for anyone that's even close to my age, this is probably your perception of Africa, right? We grew up in the era of the Lion King. Everybody sang the songs. We knew the story. But my story is a little bit different than that. That was one of my favorite movies growing up. But as was mentioned in the introduction, I'm a native Texan. I grew up in a really small town in West Texas, the daughter of a big game hunter. So this was our living room growing up. I grew up surrounded by lions and zebras and all of these animals from Africa. So I always knew in my heart and soul that I was going to get to Africa in some way. I'm not a hunter. I had no interest in going on a hunting safari, but I knew that there was a calling for me to go and visit Africa, and I didn't know how that was going to play out. So instead, I went to medical school, logical next choice, and I moved from Texas to Kentucky, where I completed my general surgery training. And during that time, I had the opportunity to spend a month at Tenwick Hospital, which I know you guys have heard mentioned a couple of times in this conference. And that was one of those serendipitous, life-changing moments. So I went from Texas to Kentucky, all the way over to Africa, so all the way over to Western Kenya, and then came back and fell into that role of the busy chief surgical resident. My time was not my own. I had no opportunity to go and do anything else. I finished my fellowship, and then I started my faculty job. So now I live in Wisconsin, which looks like this. I'm just kidding. It kind of does look like this. So I've been up there for about a year and a half, and about 6 weeks after I got there, I got an email saying, we have a short-term thyroid surgery trip, which immediately piqued my interest, saying, we need somebody to go. One of our surgeons just bailed out, and my boss forwarded this to me, and I said, I'm really interested in that. And I said, I assume by you sending me this, you're okay with your brand new faculty member taking 2 weeks off to go to Africa. And she said, go. And only after I read further into the email and studied the trip a little more did I realize this was Kenya Relief, kenyarelief.org. I sat in your seat 2 years ago and listened to Steve James talk about his story and how he founded this organization and knew that that was a life-changing moment. It was unbelievable that I was able to work with this group. So I went on this trip in January of 2017, where we did about 50 surgeries, mostly thyroid surgeries, in a period of 3 days. And these are some of our patients. It doesn't project super well, but I think you guys can probably see here Miss Helen with a huge, huge goiter here on the left of the screen. And that's one of the patients we were able to operate on. Again, an eye-opening experience. I said, wow, there's a tremendous amount of need here. How do we bring surgical care to this part of the world? So I was exposed, and the next step is to get educated and understand what type of a problem are we dealing with here. And for anyone that's studied global surgery, the statistics are pretty eye-opening. The scope of the problem is that about 5 billion people out of 7 billion people in this world have zero access to basic surgical care. That's something as simple as a cesarean section for obstructed labor, an open fracture reduction, drainage of an abscess. These are things that people die from routinely, and we have none of that here. The estimate is that about 143 million additional surgeries are needed every year. And I love to operate. It's my favorite thing to do, but I can't do 143 million surgeries in a year. So the studies have shown us we need about 2.2 million more surgeons, anesthetists, and obstetricians to help even start treating this problem. But as you guys might imagine, there's a little bit of a problem with that problem. I don't know if you are surgeons or if you've met surgeons, but surgeons have some baggage. okay? As much as I'd love to just pack my suitcase and go, I can't do what I do without a tremendous amount of other people and resources. I need nurses. I need scrub techs. I need anesthetists. I need a pre-op and PACU area. I need a lot of equipment. It's more than just a scalpel and a pair of pickups. And so building surgery as a public health initiative is actually a really big struggle. And many people have even questioned, can surgery be a public health initiative? This is not what you typically think of when you think of infectious disease campaigns, vaccination campaigns, basic community health. How on earth do we take an operating room to a place that may not even have electricity? How do we do that? And is it even worthwhile? How much surgical disease is really out there? Studies have shown us, and this is from a 2012 study looking at Rwanda, that up to about 30% of household deaths could be attributable to a basic surgical cause. And that's things from abdominal distension and pain, congenital deformities, burns, a tremendous problem, especially in parts of rural Africa, or wounds. All of those things could potentially be treated by surgery. So that's a pretty significant number of deaths. And when we actually put numbers on that, it comes out to be about 1.8 million deaths a year that are potentially avertible by basic surgical care. And when I say basic surgical care, I'm talking about what has now been defined as the bellwether procedure. So three main things: laparotomy for trauma, cesarean section, and open fracture reduction. If you can provide those three things in a first level hospital, district hospital, you could potentially save one life every 18 seconds. So clearly this is something that we should address. How much money is that going to cost? As we've studied more and more of this, it's actually more effective, more cost effective than some of the very traditional public health initiatives that you think of. Basic surgical services, more cost effective than antiretroviral therapy for HIV. So when done appropriately, we can do this effectively and very cost effectively as well. So let's talk a little bit about some of the gaps. Where do we struggle when we're trying to build surgical capacity? The first and the most obvious gap is clinical supply, right? If you don't take it with you, odds are you'll find it there. This was the pharmacy at our hospital or clinic in Migori, and you notice there's about 10 bottles of Tums sitting right there. That was my entire suitcase, my first trip. as a thyroid surgeon, problems with low calcium is something that I worry about after my surgery. So thinking, you know, I bet they can't just walk down to Walmart and buy a bottle of Tums. The lady at Walmart thinks I have the worst reflux on the planet. But I took enough Tums that if my patients had problems, I'd be able to address that. We are fairly well stocked where we are in Migori, but we don't have everything. Most of our operating room equipment has been brought by us. So OR tables, suction machines, the Bovie, the anesthesia machines, all of these things have come over on carts that we have shipped across the ocean to get there. And this is a picture of one of our ORs. We have two ORs with two tables in each operating room. So you're doing back-to-back surgery. So you might be operating here and your friend's operating behind you, which is a really phenomenal experience to be able to just holler over there and say, hey, can you come take a look at this and share the experience and get a lot of cases done very quickly and very safely, which is something we're gonna talk about in just a minute. The second major gap is in access to care. How far away are some of these patients? A lot of our patients have to travel 5 or 6 hours on the back of a motorbike to get to us. So we have to think about that when we're offering them a surgery, that's how they're gonna leave as well. We're gonna send them 5 hours on the back of a motorbike into a very rural setting. And it's on us as the providers to make sure that we're choosing safe surgeries to do in that setting. We have to make sure that it's safe. We have security all around our clinic. We make sure that our providers and our patients are safe. We have to make sure that it's affordable. The statistics from 2013 said that the average Kenyan daily income was $2 to $3 a day. $2 to $3 a day. I guarantee you most of us probably spent more than that at Starbucks this morning. And so we have to be able to offer cost-effective procedures that don't bankrupt our patients. We have to figure out how to address the delays. Patients that come from 8, 9 hours away aren't gonna go to the doctor for something minor. And so when they show up in our clinic, they often show up with diseases like this. Masses that have gotten so far out of control, we would have all been to the doctor years ago for something like this, but they simply didn't have the ability to do that. And when we have a clinic lined up, there are patients that will come 3 days in advance waiting on us and sleep on the front lawn. And that's a very
eye-opening, life-changing thing to show up at your clinic ready to do what you do every day and take for granted and have patients and family members sleeping in a line. On our last trip in January, one of the probably most life-changing moments for me, again, was I saw a patient. I had scheduled her for surgery. I put her on the third day of our schedule. And afterwards, the nurse practitioner that was doing the anesthesia workup came up to me and said, "Is there any way you could do her on Monday instead of Wednesday?" I said, "Why?" And she said, "She's here with her infant, and she's sleeping on the concrete, and she has nobody else to help her." So you stop and think for a moment, this woman is sleeping on concrete with her newborn child for me to be able to help her. And it kind of stops you in your tracks a little bit. And you think, yes, I can do that surgery on Monday. So you rearrange your entire schedule. But that's what you do in this setting. We do have to charge a little bit of a fee just to keep our doors open and be able to provide care. Our typical fee schedule, which again may not project, our thyroidectomies are about 7,000 shillings. That translates to $70. Now, I'm not in charge of the billing at my current hospital, but I can tell you roughly the bill that goes out for me to do a thyroidectomy is $10,000. So that tells you what we can accomplish for relatively little. I'm going to give you an example of a patient that came to see us this year that was pretty much an extreme example of disease and why we need to build more surgical capacity in this setting. JT is a 28-year-old gentleman who was admitted to one of the nearby teaching hospitals that I visited for a couple of days before our thyroid surgery camp in Megory. He came in for a femur fracture, fall from standing. So that should immediately raise your suspicion. Something's not right if a 28-year-old male broke his leg just by tripping and broke the strongest bone in the body, essentially, by tripping. Once we examined him, we found out that not only had he broken his femur, previously he had broken his humerus and never sought treatment for it. So that's how it healed. So there's his humerus, healed at a right angle. So that arm is essentially non-functional. A very astute resident that was working on treating this patient on the orthopedic service thought to check a calcium level. And his calcium was sky high, as was his parathyroid hormone. So for an endocrine surgeon, that is bells and whistles for me because that means primary hyperparathyroidism, which is a surgically treatable disease and can be caught very early. We were blessed enough to have an ultrasound in this clinic, and I was able to ultrasound him and see about a 3-centimeter mass sitting in his left neck that we were able to take to the operating room and take out. Nobody in this hospital had ever seen that disease surgically treated. We had 17 medical students crammed into our operating room, every one of them wanting to look at what was happening through an incision this big. So we made them line up one by one. We held the wound open and let them see. And what we were able to take out was essentially a ping pong ball sized tumor that was responsible for all of this man's symptoms. And I was thrilled to find out that a few days ago we got our pathology back. This was not a cancer, which was something we were suspicious of. And his calcium is now normal and he actually feels much better. Now we're working on fixing his bones. So when we talk about these, we have to think about the outcomes and the quality of care we provide for our patients. You cannot cut and run. And that's one of the big critiques of some of the shorter term medical missions, and that's particularly relevant for surgical missions. You can't go and operate on a human and leave them with no resources. If you go and provide some antibiotics or a vaccine, you can probably safely leave the area the next day. If I put an incision on a human being, I can't just run away the next day. We have to ensure that they have options should a complication arise. We had a patient in the middle of the night this year develop a hematoma, and a life-threatening one that required the entire team to run across the highway in the middle of the night in the dark, get to the clinic, and open up the neck wound. And we were able to treat her, and she did fine. But part of what we face when we're looking at building surgical capacity in a setting like this and in an ambulatory surgery model is how can we make sure our patients are safe? So that's one of the things we're working on at Kenya Relief is figuring out what can safely be done right now. We don't have an inpatient building. We have an ambulatory surgery center where our patients spend one night in the PACU afterwards, and then we let them go home. So we have to make sure we can continue to do that. They sleep in the recovery room, they go home the next morning. Unless there's a problem, of course, we can keep them longer. But I'm happy to say, as we continue to grow, our first 23-bed inpatient building is opening in the next couple of months. Yes, we're very, very excited about that. Now, when you talk about the local health system, you think you might be getting some quality from some of the nearby hospitals. This is a history and physical from a patient that I was called to see who essentially has end-stage lymphoma and is actively dying. She's an 18-year-old female. And what caught my attention was this was one of the district hospitals, the profit hospitals, where this patient paid for care. And just look at what her physical exam is. Sick-looking. That's it. And that's not a lie. She was sick-looking. But that tells me nothing. And this patient's father paid probably dollars that he does not have for that type of care. And so it's on us to make sure that we're doing better than that. And we give our patients a full physical examination, and we document that so that we don't have somebody coming in who paid for this, and that's not worth what they paid for. So we should do this, clearly. We should help and build surgical capacity, but how do we do it? This will probably be a little hard to read, but it talks about the different platforms for building surgical care. Short-term temporary missions have kind of shown that that's not really an ideal thing for surgery. You can't drop in and drop out. So what's a little more ideal is something that's temporary maybe, but self-contained. And I would say this is where Kenya Relief has been for the last several years. We have people that are on the ground full-time, but we don't have a full surgical staff. We're working our way up to that. Right now, this is potentially equivalent to developed world settings. Outcomes are great, and there is a platform available for training, and we were able to do some of that this year. But where we're headed, and the ideal place to be, is the level of the surgical specialty hospital. And that's a place that's equivalent to developed countries. It's the most cost-effective of all of the options for surgical care. And there is a definite role for training the low and middle-income local surgeons. We had two Kenyan residents this time that came down and joined our trip, and they were able to do 58 thyroid surgeries with high-volume endocrine surgeons, who that's all we do every day. And I guarantee you those two guys left and went back feeling significantly more comfortable taking care of that type of disease and treating that surgically. So that's the next step. So everybody always wants to know, what's it like over there? How do you even go, and what are we doing right now? So typically in an afternoon, we'll see about 300 clinic patients. And those are patients that have been sort of pre-identified, put on a list and screened for us, saying that if we're a thyroid surgery team, they have a neck mass of some sort. And then it's up to us to figure out, is this actually a thyroid problem? Is this something we can treat here? How do we go about that? So the patients come into the clinic rooms, and they work their way down the hallway, and ultimately get into the clinic room where we see them. And it's four beds, a surgeon manning each bed, along with our nurse and our translator to help us assess the patients. And we talk to them and figure out what's going on. Is this a thyroid problem? Are they symptomatic from this? Have they had any sort of evaluation? Have they had any workup? We do the blood work that we can. And if we think it's appropriate and safe, then we'll treat them, and that can provide surgery with minimal cost and, most importantly, minimal morbidity. We have some ultrasound available, which is wonderful because it allows us to assess like we would back home. I consider the ultrasound an extension of my arm, and so that's part of my physical exam. And to be able to do that in that setting is critical. And it helps us make really appropriate decisions about what can and can't be treated. This was our surgical fellow that we brought with us this year, teaching some of the local people how to do ultrasound and what we're looking for when we're examining the thyroid. And this is a typical patient that will come in. So this woman walked in off the street, wasn't particularly symptomatic, but definitely had a goiter. So we said, we'll talk with you. One of the fellow surgeons that was working with me performed her ultrasound, and something that looks like a not terrible goiter looked like this on ultrasound. And for anyone who hasn't seen this, the thyroid actually doesn't look that bad, but what struck us was this right here. And that tiny sliver is her trachea. It's very compressed. And so these are the type of things that walk in off the street for you to deal with. And you have to decide at that time, is this a patient that we can safely operate on? How do we manage that airway in a setting where we may not have all of the resources? And I'm proud to say we actually have tremendous anesthesia resources to do a video laryngoscopy for intubation. But what ended up happening next was kind of a surprise to all of us. Her oxygen saturations dropped a little bit after intubation. And we had a lot of secretions coming out, and we figured out this is not a surgery we can safely do in our setting. So you have to know when to say when. And we said, we're not doing this surgery. We woke her up, we monitored her after extubation, and she did very well, but we're able to refer her on to another facility that has a little more resources than we do. So that's how you monitor that in the ambulatory setting. This is our pre-op area, so the patients are lined up 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they're going to OR tables 1, 2, 3, and 4. We try to keep everything as organized as possible. Like I said, we have 2 surgeons operating in the same room at the same time. We use pretty minimal resources. This was one of our surgeons, this team, teaching the 2 Kenyan residents, Caleb and Chacha, how to do thyroid surgery. Everyone that went on our team this year was very, very committed to education and trying to make sure that the residents, whether it was our U.S. surgical fellows or our Kenyan residents, got a really valuable experience, and they were doing the operation, and they learned how to do this. This is our PACU, and I think probably my favorite story, one of the things that popped out to me the first time I was in Migori, was looking at the PACU monitors and seeing the little post-it notes, which would highlight works, doesn't work, good for blood pressure. And our PACU nurses learned that you could get all the information you needed, but you might have your patient hooked up to 3 different monitors at once. And then when somebody else said, hey, I need a blood pressure, there you go. So you learn how to share and work together and realize that you don't have to have everything you think you do. This is our sterilization room. These are our laundry ladies. Laundry's done in the corner of the bathroom and then hung out to dry. And PACU phase 2 is a tent on the front lawn, which is now next to our new inpatient building, so it's a little bit more controlled, but we certainly were surprised the first time we had to go find our patient on the front lawn, and that's where they were sleeping. But you make sure that they're totally comfortable out there. So then when it comes time to send these patients home, we've kind of alluded to this, what do we have to think about as we're letting people leave our clinic? They may often travel 5 hours. They may be on the back of a motorbike. They may be going to a place where they have no access to clean water. They're guaranteed to have minimal follow-up because for a lot of them, we can't get them to come back to see us. Even if we're there to follow them up, we can't bring them back. How do you convince people that this is important and you need to come back? And you actually have to think about modifying your discharge instructions. You know, my patients in Wisconsin, I tell them, you're not gonna wanna lift anything super heavy for about 2 weeks. Standard post-neck surgery instruction. I never thought I would have to tell somebody, you can't carry anything on your head for a couple of weeks. And while that looks relatively lightweight, imagine seeing your post-op patient doing that. So you learn to think outside of the box of what you might actually have to tell them. This is a home of one of the families, and this is a cleaned up home. They were really proud for us to visit this, but you have to think, I've put an incision on this patient, and they're going to a place where that's their water resources, that's their cleanliness level. How do I make sure they don't end up with an infection when we're gone? All the things you have to think about and modify as you're treating patients surgically. So there are a lot of challenges in doing this. Stepping back a little bit from our particular scenario, let's think a little bit about Africa in perspective. And this is something that I think surprises a lot of people when you, I know a lot of the topics here have been focused on Africa. So everybody says, why are we always talking about Africa? Let's think about the size of the land mass. This is Africa, and this is to scale. This little purple blob here is the United States. So it is a huge landmass. There are so many people on the continent of Africa that need help. And you just tend to forget about the size of this area. The lack of resources is pretty alarming as well. This figure shows the number of people per doctor, and this is not per surgeon, this is just per doctor. And I know you can't read the little numbers. The United States is about 390 to 1. But I'm pretty sure you can see the big red numbers that show in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, 50,000 people for 1 doctor. The surgical statistics are even worse. There are countries in Africa where there are 12 million people for 1 surgeon. And I physically cannot, I mean, I can't even fathom taking care of that many patients as the only surgeon for miles and miles around, perhaps the only surgeon in the country. Everybody's worried about Ebola. There are plenty of places you can go in Africa where it's not a problem. So don't let that deter you from considering a trip. You might have to work without electricity. You learn to think outside of the box. This was me, not thrilled, operating by the battery-powered headlight. But as we've grown from this, we now have generators in place that allow us to only have a power outage for a few seconds, and everything immediately kicks back on. But I will tell you, the first 5 minutes of operating without electricity was pretty terrifying for me as a surgeon. But you learn, and you get through it. Turns out you don't need a lot of the fancy things you need. This is from a different organization that I've worked with, but you might find yourself being the only female surgeon in a place that's not particularly friendly to female surgeons. Again, you learn, you work through it. And by the end of it, everyone was having a wonderful time and they all learned how to do great thyroid surgery. So part of this is about pushing yourself outside of that comfort zone. For anyone that heard the talk last night, you have to kind of live on the edge a little bit and go to a place that maybe you may not feel the most safe, but that's where you're called to be. So why do we struggle when we're trying to build surgical capacity? Hopefully, this will leave you with a few more questions than answers. There have been some really great talks this year, particularly at the American College of Surgeons meeting, about some of the ethical considerations for global surgery and things that we need to think about. And I do not claim to have the answers. This makes me think even harder about the questions, though. What should the goal of surgery be when we're going on these trips? Should our goal be to do a bunch of cases that can't be done by the local providers? Or should our goal be to teach those local providers how to do that surgery? I would argue that it's a little bit of both. Another argument is, what should we be doing as far as autonomy and scope of practice? I took my surgical fellows this year. Should I let them do something that they wouldn't necessarily be doing independently in the United States? What if I'm operating in a setting where somebody comes in and needs an emergency C-section? I know how to do it. Haven't done it since medical school. Should I be allowed to do that? How do we expand our scope but do it safely? What are the standards of care and consent? How do you consent someone that doesn't speak your language? A lot of medical research and surgical research, particularly now, is talking about shared decision-making with our patients and making sure that when you're signing up for a surgery, you fully understand what that surgery is, what those risks are, and how to make the right decision for you. How do you do that in a setting where you don't speak the language with the patient so that rapport that you build is gone? You're reliant on a translator to take your words and hopefully convey that appropriately to the patient. How do we address that? And that I don't think we have a great answer for yet. And finally, how much of this can we change or adapt in natural or man-made disasters? Does anybody get the opportunity to practice outside of their normal scope in that setting? I would argue absolutely, because there is literally no other option. But how do we continue to make that better and more safe in every setting in which we do it? So I called this talk Surgical Safari because as I started thinking about it this year, safari really is tracking the local population. And that's, in this setting, often a wildlife population. But when we're trying to build surgical capacity in a low-resource setting, we're observing the local population. And it really is like a safari. Protocols are not universal. And you have to adapt whatever you're going to do to the setting that you're going to be in. And what works in Kenya may not work in Zambia. What works in Zambia may not work in Ethiopia. So part of the success story is that you have to do what fits into the local environment. I think this is probably one of the most important slides from this. Everybody talks about building, we want equality. We want equality across the world. And I would argue that's not what we want. What we want is equity. And that's the quintessential struggle of building surgical capacity, is not everybody starting off on a level playing field. And you gotta understand that. So how do we adapt to do this in a place where there are practicing surgeons? We have to look at how adults learn best. We have to figure out how to teach for retention. Practicing surgeons do not learn best by sitting in a lecture hall and having me tell them how to do a thyroid. That doesn't help. We have to figure out what the local providers think is the most effective option. And that can require a fair bit of research before you actually start building. There are a couple of things that we do wrong, and I'm sure some of the other talks you guys have heard have alluded to this. There's a fabulous article that was published in the World Journal of Surgery that highlights the seven sins of humanitarian medicine. The first is leaving a mess behind. As I said, you can't cut and run. You can't leave patients with postoperative complications. You have to have appropriate case selection, and in a lot of these settings, simpler is better, so keep that in mind. You have to match technology to what the local providers can handle. So the first time I went to Tenwick, I took our laparoscopic skills curriculum and taught the residents there how to pass the little pegs back and forth and how to do that, and it worked. And it was wonderful, but after I left, nobody really kept that up. So I don't know how beneficial that particular project was. A lot of organizations are doing exactly the same work and may not even realize it. It's really frustrating when NGOs don't cooperate or coordinate, and you end up competing against each other, replicating work that's already been done, or even sometimes actively working against each other. You cannot ignore the concept of a follow-up plan. I was raised with the mentality that failing to plan is planning to fail. you have to keep going back to the same location. You want to build a footprint where you are that's going to stay long after your time has gone. You can't allow politics, training, or other goals to disrupt your service. This is not vacation. As a surgeon, this is not about case numbers. I do block out the word training here because I think training actually is becoming the key for global surgery. That's teaching our surgeons how to do this in that setting, and that's teaching local surgeons how to do advanced procedures. You can't go where you're not wanted. You have to work in cooperation with the local government, with the local rules and authorities, and you have to make sure that they're accepting of your presence in their environment. We don't always have the answers, and you have to respect local traditions and rules. You have to work with the people you're trying to help. And finally, doing the right thing, but doing it for the wrong reason. I know a lot of people have this idea of, I want to go and do a global surgical trip. This is not voluntourism. These are real people with real problems, and you're there to help. This is not about your agenda. So why do we succeed? Kenya Relief has done an amazing job of treating more than 125,000 Kenyans. They're doing it safely. We're performing large volume outpatient surgeries, but with a focus on appropriate patient selection. They've built community and regional relationships. If you've stopped by the booth, I'm sure you've heard about the myriad of outreach programs that we have, everything from the school to the orphanage to the prison ministry to the clinic. It's growing every day. And by trying to do it in this ambulatory care model, I think we're showing that you can improve access and lower costs. So what we know is if you build it, they will come. This was the cafeteria 1 year ago. This is that building now in 1 year. So this is the theme for global surgery. If you've tried it, you know. Trust me, this is every day. But you just keep working on it. So I'm gonna leave you with a couple of lessons learned, and then if you'll indulge me, I have a 3-minute video that we filmed that will show you a little bit more about what we do in Migori. And I know you guys have heard this theme as well. We have to remember this: to whom much is given, much is expected. I've been blessed to train at 3 institutions. I've trained at the University of Kentucky, at MD Anderson Cancer Center, and now I work at the University of Wisconsin. Just look at the size of those buildings and the resources held within. It is my responsibility to take that out and do for others what has been given to me. It's not that scary. So anybody that's seen a little baby warthog take off running knows that they run with their tail straight up in the air, and this was 4 little babies that took off when we drove past them. You don't have to be afraid. It is where you're supposed to be. And you go, and as we talked about last night, you have to either be safe or be brave. If you want to make the biggest difference, you got to find the greatest need. Go where the red numbers are on this map. Go where nobody else is, and be the person that provides that care. And finally, the quintessential quote from anybody that's involved in global health of any kind is from Dr. Paul Farmer, who's one of the founders of really the whole field. And that is, the idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that's wrong in the world. So I thank you for your attention. If you'll give me just 3 minutes, I'm going to show you this video as well, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you guys might have. In the end of it, you know, you get 100 times more than you give.
I would say that it'll probably change your entire outlook on life.
This okay?
We just finished 3 days of surgery here in Migori, Kenya with Kenya Relief.
One of the main things that I believe and that I want to live on beyond me, and that's that anybody who comes, anyone of goodwill who comes and wants to partner with us, we stand side by side. People from all backgrounds come together and you see the best in humanity come out.
Medical background, not medical background, are you religious, are you not religious? It really doesn't matter, it's the mindset that you come here in. You're coming to give something of yourself and leave it here.
That's what Kenya Relief has done better than any place I've ever seen, is he puts 20 random strangers together and says, you're gonna work in the highest stress of situations and you're gonna help people.
If you're thinking about coming and you're worried that you may not be able to participate or fit in, or that your skill set's a little bit different, just come. There is a need for everybody here.
You don't have to be a doctor. You just have to be a human willing to work hard.
We really have the opportunity to change lives together.
no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. When you really do put that ego aside and you're here for the greater good, it's not about you, it's about the patient who's on the table who needs your help. And that's all that matters at the end of the day.
It's not defensive medicine. You just come here and you just do what you know how to do best.
It's a really great thing to be able to take something that you do every day and make it into a very special, life-changing thing for somebody.
There's no sense of entitlement here.
There's no expectation, there's only gratitude. People just want to be helped.
Well, oftentimes we go day in and day out and don't get a lot of appreciation for what we do. The smiles of the people here are infectious. Coming here, you'd meet some of the most wonderful people in the world.
It just helps you remember the purpose of you being on this earth. You can come up with a million reasons to why not to come, but there's only one reason to come, is because you just kind of have to.
You know, my friends and family tell me, oh, I don't know how you do it. And having been here now twice, I think, I don't know how you don't. Like, this is our responsibility to the world.
Just try it. Just step out of your comfort zone. What if you did? Just what if you did?
All right. So thank you guys for that. Yeah. Yes. You're good. You're good.
Christianity was presented in that room was
No, I think you're hitting on part of the core of what we're trying to do, which is make this sustainable and leave a footprint so that we don't, I would love nothing more than to be worked out of a job. And I would love to bring the Kenyan residents over here with us. Right now, you are hitting on the nail on the head. The regulations and the rules and trying to get somebody over here is almost insurmountable. So what we've tried to do to come around that is have the Kenyan residents join us in Migori and work together and build that. And our hope is that we'll get more and more trainees. And eventually, like you said, we won't even have to go and continue to empower the people there. Make this sustainable and make this so that we're not taking equipment over there and leaving it where it can't be serviced. There are ways to buy equipment within Kenya and have the Kenyan people be able to service it and slowly but surely build that hospital so that we don't even have to be there. And that, I think, is our overall goal is you, and I can't believe you said it perfectly, this is the point of our slide this year and our logo is that we want this to be one Kenya. We know there are tribal conflicts within Kenya, there are conflicts within the United States, but all of that goes aside and we all work together to make this a place where everybody gets the care that they need with no ego and no agenda. And we do it because that is our calling as Christians. This is our faith in action. And we help everybody get to every level. It's helping us. It's helping the people of Kenya. It's helping everywhere we can. And it does empower them to be able to do this on their own. And that's what we want as our long-term goal. So thank you for that. Other questions? Yeah. Oh, so you need to talk to Steve right there. Steve runs the organization. We take about 20 teams a year, and that's everything from surgical teams. We have dental teams, eye teams. There's education, vacation Bible school. All our little programs that we have all of the dates for the teams, and they're usually about 10-day trips. It's all-inclusive. The security, the food, the lodging, all of that's taken care of with the organization, and as far as a concise, efficient, safe, short-term trip, it's the most well-run thing I've ever been a part of. Thank you. We're thankful that you're here. Sure.
I respect other people's perspective on what's going on, but it's undeniable that what you do and what the Human Relief Organization and all the non-profit organizations do for Africa is inestimable. So I want to say thank you again and continue to do what you do.
Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Come with us. Yes. You're going to want to talk to Natalie Ware right there. She's one of my PAs that went with me on this last trip. So absolutely, I mean, there's a role for everybody. You might be doing things that you weren't expecting to do, but we can absolutely use everybody. Yeah. That goes along with the debate of practicing outside of your scope of autonomy and what are you able to do. I think that advanced practice providers could be critical for that. The person that is essentially on the ground running our clinic most of the time is essentially a nurse practitioner. And he's there when we're not. And to be able to have that consistency and have somebody there, I think that is critical. Yes, you had one question. As far as what we, like right now where we are, it's about $1,900 per person, and that's, oh, for the whole team? Good question. What would you say? What is the cost to outfit the OR? Like what we have? Yeah. It's come over piecemeal over time and what we've been able to get. And so putting a total number on that would be awfully hard. As far as like electronic, oh, we have Wi-Fi. Yeah. It's good. We got Wi-Fi. Life is good. Yes, ma'am. Okay. I think it was our laparoscopic skills curriculum, and I think it just simply came down to there wasn't that much time to keep it going. The surgical residents, both here and in Kenya, are extremely strapped for time. I mean, there's just not enough hours in the day. I spent 6 years in surgical residency, and I needed 36 hours in a 24-hour day. And the patient volume at those hospitals is so much better. I mean, it just never stops. And so to find dedicated time for residents to pull out for education is a struggle that we have even here. I can't even, you know, now it's become sort of a mandate. And so for my residents at the University of Wisconsin, every Wednesday morning, they have 2 hours where they don't answer their pagers. And our advanced practice providers run the patient, I mean, keep everything copacetic while they're in dedicated teaching conference time. But that's a slow-moving process. I think it's where we're headed as we get more and more formal residency programs and follow some of the more traditional curriculum. But it's a hard thing to do to pull a clinical provider out and say, we're going to pull you out for 2 hours, and here's your dedicated practice time. At Tenwick, yes, they are. We, I don't think, have done anything laparoscopic just yet. But as an ambulatory model, that's ideal. So. Usually about 10 days to 2 weeks. And that's all, that's encompassing travel time as well. So it's fairly quick. Certain teams, maybe they're a little bit longer or a little bit shorter, depending on what they're doing.
On average, how many patients are you able to
make on a day? So on a day, 15 to 20. This last trip, we did 58 surgeries in 3 days and saw about 300 medical patients as well. I have clinic on the schedule, but that's just for clinic. My normal operating day is 3. But that being said, the 58 surgeries were with 4 surgeons. I certainly wasn't, you know, running around like a Tasmanian devil. No. Yes, sir. That is 100% a work in progress. One of the things we're trying to do is streamline and make our operative reports and our order sets easier. We don't have an electronic medical record, but that's in the long-term vision. You know, we don't have the regulation on documentation, and it's certainly not documentation for billing, like everyone that practices here or uses Epic or, you know, has to document so many things to get it to a level 4 and bill such and such, and that's not what we have to deal with, fortunately. But there are records kept, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Right, so we actually kind of deliberately on our last operative day start to slow down the acuity of the case. If we have a really big goiter like Miss Helen that you saw in the video, that's done on the first day that we're there, so we have several days if there's a complication. Our last day, we try to do smaller stuff that's even maybe just done under local anesthesia. We do a lot of lipomas, maybe some small hernias, things that we are very confident will be able to go home without incident. You know, having 20 teams a year going over, even if somebody's gone for it, one team leaves, another team is pretty quickly on the way. And then we've also worked to build our relationships with the nearby university hospitals. We have referred patients to Tenwick very frequently. This year, we've started to work with Moy Teaching and Referral Hospital. Residents came from this year. And so we've got lots of options as far as places that patients can go if they have a problem.